if you had the ability to time travel, which would be cool in a lot of ways, but if you could do that and you could visit one of the churches in the first century that we read about in the pages of the New Testament, which church would you go to? Which church would you choose to place your membership in and become a part of the work there? Maybe some of us, Jerusalem, the church there would be the first one to pop up into our minds because they're the church that had the apostles, at least for a long time. They're the church that had elders. They're the church where the first converts in Acts chapter 2 joined together and then the gospel spread from them in that church. That'd be pretty neat. Maybe you would choose to be a part of the church at Antioch later on in the book of Acts. Antioch sponsored Paul and Barnabas and other guys as they went out throughout the Mediterranean preaching, starting churches. There were lots of teachers, different kinds of miracles being produced in that church. That'd be a pretty cool place to go to and be a part of that work. Maybe you would think of the two churches in the book of Revelation, Philadelphia and Smyrna, about which God had nothing negative to say. Maybe they'd be cool churches to be a part of. But I'm guessing that there's one church that does not float to the top of your list when you're thinking about great New Testament churches that you would love to be a part of. I'm guessing nobody would want to be a part of Corinth. Am I right about that? Would you choose to join the Corinthian church if your company moved you to Greece, you know, in the first century, and you were looking for a church? Would you go there? Let me maybe ask the question a little bit differently. If you were already part of the Corinthian church, would you choose to stay there? Or would you say to your wife, to your kids, that's it, let's worship at home. That's it, let's just break off from these wackos and let's start a different church because this place is, as they say in the South, a hot mess. Maybe you'd like a refresh on what they were like. Let's talk about what kind of a church this was as we're thinking about whether we would want to be a part of it or not. In chapters 1 through 4 of the first letter of Corinthians, so 1 Corinthians 1 through 4, Paul spends chapters dealing with the division that is just all over the place in all the relationship dynamics of this spiritual family. In fact, you had people that were basing their spiritual maturity compared to other Christians on who baptized them. And so some people are saying, well, I'm of Paul, or I'm of Apollos, or I'm of Cephas, or I'm of Jesus. This guy baptized me. Well, this guy immersed me in water for the forgiveness of sins, and that puts me over you. Just ridiculous language happening inside of this family. So he has to deal with that and say, look, is Jesus divided? You're all one in him. You got to act like it. You got to think that way. In chapter 5 of 1 Corinthians, we just turn the page and we find out there is a disgusting romance happening inside this church. You've got a guy who is living with his father's wife, probably his mother-in-law, and they're proud of it. And Paul says, this is absolutely shocking to me because even when the pagans look over at you guys, at what you're doing, they cringe. And Greek culture, I mean, there are not a lot of bashful people in Greek culture. They did a lot of bad things too, but they looked at the Corinthians and thought, ew, that's disgusting. And Paul says, you need to deal with this. You're proud of this guy? You're proud of your liberation and your romance that you got here? You've got to make sure that this guy is not allowed to just continue with you guys in this relationship. In chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians, we find out that there are members that are suing each other. They're taking their petty differences and they're going outside of the church to a public court and going before a magistrate who is not a Christian and trying to deal with their differences there. And Paul says, look, is there not anybody inside of your congregation who is wise enough to sit down with the two parties and help you guys resolve the arguments that you've got? There's no need to do this. You're dishonoring yourselves and Jesus through your actions. And then later on in chapter 6, we find out that some of the men, I don't know how many of the men, are visiting prostitutes in the city. And so they are thinking about the sexual relationship just in terms of eating. You know, food is for the body and the body's for food. Paul says, no, it's not. That is not the way you think about this relationship. That is unique and special between a husband and a wife. And so do not dishonor your body by doing this. In chapter 10, you have members that are going to idolatrous temples and feasting there with the pagans as they celebrate Zeus or Aphrodite or any of the other gods or goddesses that the Corinthians worshipped. And they looked at it just in terms of, well, we can do this because we have knowledge that that idol isn't anything. And so we can go and we can sit at the table with all these people as they're worshiping and praising. And we're not doing that. We don't have to praise them, but we could just have the feast along with everybody else. And Paul says, no, you cannot. Do you not realize that you're worshiping demons when you go and you sit at that table and you eat at that feast? That's a mess. That is really serious. You may not have a satanic symbol on the bumper sticker you put on your car, but you got to realize who you are worshiping when you go there and you do that. And speaking of feasting, the real feast, the Lord's Supper feast that they should have been harmoniously participating in every Sunday, was a disaster. Because if you go to chapter 11, you notice that there are rich Christians who are bringing their food to the table and they are gorging themselves. And they're showing off how much money and how much food they have. And you got a poor brother sitting right next to them who has nothing. He's being embarrassed and dishonored, and the rich guy's getting drunk and dishonoring Christ and himself. And so Paul has to address that very directly and say, look, if you want to have a feast, you can go to your McMansion and do that there. But when you come together as a church, you had better be looking out for the needs and interests of others and not just your own. The Lord's Supper is about a celebration of Him and our unity in Him and not about you. In chapter 12, we find out in Corinth, there was a weird culture around spiritual gifts. So there were a lot of churches, I'm sure, that had guys and women in it who could do spiritual things in very special, miraculous ways. But in Corinth, there seemed to be this really big fixation on the spiritual gift of speaking in tongues. And so Paul has to spend a lot of time on that and say, look, that gift isn't more important than all the other ones. God, the Spirit gave all these gifts so that His church could be unified. And so if you're speaking in tongues, but you don't even have an interpreter, you can't even exercise your gift by yourself in the way that God intends. You're dependent on other people. And you're certainly dependent on the Spirit who gives all those blessings. In chapter 14, we find out that there are women in this church who are seizing leadership roles inside of the assembly that Paul says that they should not be exercising. And so the worship services are chaotic. Everybody's kind of just jumping up and trying to seize the reins. And so Paul has to say, look, there is an orderly way to get together to worship God and to talk about His words, and it's not reflected in what you're doing. In chapter 15, you see, it's just one thing after another. It's not just one or two issues. It's a whole boatload in this church. Just about everything that you could think of that might go wrong, went wrong in the church at Corinth. In chapter 15, you got false teaching. Not about who wrote the book of Hebrews or some kind of thing like that, but about the resurrection of the dead. You got people in this church who are embracing the Greek culture around them and saying, you know, bodies don't come out of graves. That's just ridiculous. And Paul says, look, if that doesn't happen, then that means Jesus is still in His grave. And if that's the case, you're still dead in your sins. And you have not been set free from the spiritual darkness that you were in before. And so he's got to spend this huge chapter laying out the groundwork again for, look,
Jesus was raised, we're going to be raised. If you don't believe that, here are the implications for you in your life. It's not good. So there's false teaching going on about a very serious issue. So what is your answer about this question of would you choose to be a member of this church? If your answer was no, I bet there was some really good reasons that you had for saying no to this absolute disaster of a congregation. You might say this, and this is probably what floats to the top of my list as a parent of four small children. It's a horrible environment to raise your kids in. You know, you might say that, and I can't argue with that, because we got to think about the environment that they're living in. You know, it's not just the home that they're exposed to. You know, they also rub elbows with other people, especially their church family. And so if they're there, then, you know, they're going to be exposed to a lot of things. And you know, Christians should not expect for their own church family to be a negative environment for the children that they're raising. We want godly influences on them to help lead them to Christ. You know, the hearts of my children are precious to me, and if I was in a place like this, I would think long and hard about the influences that they are being exposed to. So maybe something like this would be something that you might think about if your answer was no. Well, they are worshiping God, and they are living on a weekly basis in terribly ungodly, unbiblical ways. And that is absolutely true. The assembly was a wreck. People are jumping up and using gifts at inappropriate times. There's chaos. Now, something else you might think about is that there were false teachers that are actively influencing the group in very devious ways. Would you want to sit there and be exposed to that? Would you want to have to fight that on a regular basis? They're attacking the very foundation of your faith with the resurrection. You know, it's pretty hard to work with a group of people that are coming at that question in that kind of way. Another thing that would be something to think about is that it'd be really hard to take the Lord's Supper properly. It'd be hard to worship your God in an undistracted way if you are sitting at the table with people like this. It'd be hard to concentrate. Bottom line is, it would just be very uncomfortable. It would be very discouraging to be part of a work like this. And it would just be painful in countless ways. And so, if you were a Christian in this area, would you choose to be a part of this? If you have ever studied the idea of steadfast love in the Bible, I think you know what your answer is going to be at the end of the day. Let's think about Paul's perspective on this church. Now, he wrote this letter that we read, and he identified all of these problems. So what was in his mind? What was his attitude toward these messed up people? I think it's very interesting when you read the letter of 1 Corinthians, or the second one for that matter, he never tells the faithful Christians that are doing their work in the right kind of way in this church, he never tells them, just go worship at home. Just give up on these people. Just cut your losses and move on. Now look at 1 Corinthians chapter 11 in verse 19. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 19. I want to show you what he says. This is in the context of the Lord's Supper. He has just said, "For in the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and I believe it in part, for there must be factions among you in order that those who are genuine among you may be recognized." So there are schisms in this church, but that is for the purpose of revealing who's really on the Lord's side and who's not. And Paul doesn't say, and once those schisms have come to the surface, then the cream of the crop needs to run for the hills. Now, the cream of the crop needs to stay in Corinth and help
the rest of the brothers and sisters there to work this out. Now, is that hard? Yeah, it sure is. But that is his message to these mature Christians. You don't see him encouraging a church split. Something else that you also see is that he keeps sending his best teachers to this church. If you're Paul, and you have a very limited resource pool, you've got your Timothy, and your Titus, and your Apollos, and yourself, and maybe a handful of others, where are you going to send those guys? Are you going to send them to places that don't have churches and just say, hey, start a new group in Spain, start a new group in Germany, start a new group in wherever it is? Or are you going to send them to the churches that are doing really well and just say, hey, build up those people in those places because they have a lot of growth potential. They're doing really well. He often sent them back to Corinth. I think that's an amazing thing. If you look in chapter 16, in verse 12 of 1 Corinthians, you'll notice Paul says he urged Apollos to go. He said, hey, Apollos, buddy, you need to, they really need your help. And Apollos evidently had other things to do and said he wasn't going to go back to Corinth, but he was going to go back at some future point in time. He wasn't going to just abandon them. If you look at chapter 4, verse 17, chapter 16, verse 10, he mentions Timothy. Timothy has come. He will come in the future. Titus is mentioned in 2 Corinthians 7 and 1 Corinthians 16. Paul himself says, I want to come back to you guys. And eventually he would. So Paul did not personally give up on them, and he urged his fellow teachers to not do that as well. He steadfastly maintained his confidence in what he knew that they could grow into. If you look in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 2, this is right before the head covering passage. And he says in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 2, after he spent chapters talking about their problems, he says, now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you. Even as he chastises them, he is also praising them for what he can praise them for and say, look, you know, you guys, there are some areas of your life where you are tracking with me, and I want to encourage you in that. And in 2 Corinthians 7, in verse 16, he says something amazing there. The last verse of 2 Corinthians 7, I rejoice because I have perfect confidence in you. Could you say that to these people? Now, they had, by the time 2 Corinthians is written, they had put some things in order. They were doing some more things right. But still, could you honestly express those thoughts to a group that has this many problems? I have perfect confidence in you. I know you're going to grow. I know you're going to do it. Jesus is going to work in you. And I'm going to see you on the final day. That's a kind of attitude. Those are kind of words and language that we might have difficulty in honestly expressing. But Paul did. So, let's talk about what a church needs. When a church is in the position like a Corinth, and Paul is saying, I'm not going to give up. I would be a member there. I am going to work with you guys in the future. What does the church need to work through issues like this? We need patient and humble love, first of all. I think it's interesting that 1 Corinthians is the letter where Paul talks about what love is, famously. And he doesn't talk about what love feels like, but what love does in action. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends.
sometimes we want to take that passage out of its context and just look at it on its own, but put those statements inside the letter of 1 Corinthians and think about everything else Paul has said in that entire letter. He himself is bearing all things as he continues to try to work with them. He is hoping all things. He is enduring all things with them, and the teachers that he is sending to them are doing the same thing. So when we see weaknesses, inconsistencies in each other as a church, when we see things that are out of whack and out of step and out of line, what is our attitude? Is it to try to take a step back? Or is it to engage? Or is it to say, look, let me try to walk beside you again, and let's try to go back to the scriptures again, and let's try to work this out? We have to also have the humility to realize that for whatever specks we see in other people's eyes, they might see some logs in our own eyes. And so it's not just, well, all these people need my help, but I need to be helped too. And I've got stuff in me that I probably don't see, and so I need them to be patient with me as God calls me to be patient with them. We will always have a need to give mercy to other people, but we will always have a need to receive mercy from other people. And so he encourages that in this church. Something that else that we need to all have, if we're going to be a family together, is we need to have a willingness to experience discomfort. You know, a lot of people look for a church based on whether it's going to make them relaxed and happy and comfortable. But being a part of a church is not like picking out your next freezer, where you get a quote on this and you get a quote on that. You look at, well, here's the features of this one, here's the features of this one. I like this, I don't like that, I'll buy that. This is, you know, you might do that if you are shopping around for a product, but when we are thinking about engaging in a church, this is not a consumer mindset that he encourages us to put on to our heads here. This is a willingness to be uncomfortable so that we can be a help and an encouragement and a strength to other people, not so that, oh, I like the preaching, that suits me, or I like this, or I like that, and that makes me feel good. That's not what being in a family is all about. Not what a physical family is all about. Like, if you grew up with brothers and sisters and parents, you know that there were some tough days sometimes where people got antsy and people got snippy, but at the end of the day, you didn't say, well, that's it, I'm hitting the road. Had enough of all of you. You're living in the same house, so you got to find some way to work that out. That's what we are together as a church. That's what they were called to be. Something else that I think he encourages in this letter in 1 Corinthians, something that we need to be thinking about too, is open and internal communication. Not, I'm going to take my problems with other people here, and I'm going to talk to other people on the outside about them. That's 1 Corinthians 6. And so he calls that out and says, no. You don't go before a magistrate. You go in front of each other, and you grab a mature brother, and you sit down, and you work out those issues. Amongst people who are heaven bound, there is no such thing as irreconcilable differences. But that is the common phrase in our culture. When you don't like somebody else and you want to sever the relationship, boom, we can't work it out. That's not the way it is in the Lord's church. If we can't talk to each other about doubts and issues and problems, how in the world are we going to ever, with anybody, with any group of people, because all groups of people are imperfect, how are we going to truly become a spiritual family? So what church membership requires is a total commitment to empty oneself for the sake of Jesus' family, because that is exactly the sort of thing that he did for us. Do you think it was easy? Do you think it was comfortable for Jesus to leave the glory of heaven, as it's described in Philippians 2, to take on human flesh, to come down here and live amongst us for 3 decades? there are countless moments where Jesus would have had an opportunity to compare what he was currently experiencing with his disciples and with the Pharisees he was arguing with and with all the inconveniences and all of the discomfort that he had, to compare that with what he left to come here. That's the kind of comparison that we are not even able to make because we haven't been there yet. But he nevertheless was able and willing to do that and make that sacrifice, to even go to a horrible death on a cross for the sake of other people, not because it was comfortable, it was anything but because he wanted to give himself away. That attitude has to be in all of us if we're going to come together as a people for Jesus. So, if you think about this lesson, I ask one more time, would you be a member of the church at Corinth? I think Paul would. I think Jesus would. Obviously, we're not in Corinth. Obviously, we're not in this church. We're in this one. But we have an opportunity in the relationships that we have with each other to practice these things, no matter what differences or obstacles or problems or issues there are amongst us. This is the roadmap for us to follow. And the Lord's Supper feast that we will now commemorate is the central idea that we can rally around to make all of the rest of the things that we've been talking about in this sermon actually happen. If Jesus' sacrifice is in our hearts, then we will be prepared to sacrifice for each other.